Welcome to episode 55 of Meenal's World. Thank you all for tuning into my podcast this week and joining me with another lovely guest. This morning, I managed to go out for a walk without Radhika for the first time for as long as I can remember. I had to pop out to get some milk and I could feel the sun on my skin and hear the birds chirping. It was a lovely reminder that spring is just around the corner, which is my favorite season of the year. And I hope all of you get a chance to just take a moment to go outside and feel the sun on your skin. It's so refreshing and just a nice way to just hit a reset button after a very, very busy week. This week, I had Dr. Gavin Francis on the show. He's just released a book called Recovery, The Art of Convalescence. And we spoke about his life as a GP and writer. And he's released many books over the last few years, which don't just involve medicine. It's a collection of his learnings and his discoveries through his traveling and his experiences as a doctor, which was very refreshing to speak to a doctor who advocates for healthcare workers and people in very busy careers to take some time out and explore their passions and hobbies outside of their work. Because as we speak about it in the podcast, that with any career, burnout is very common and there are ways to avoid that. And I think we're moving towards a new sort of thinking that taking time out of work is not necessarily a bad thing. And I think that is thanks to the pandemic. And his book Recovery in particular opened my eyes to a whole new world of understanding the true concept of rest and self-care. So you can order Gavin's book on Amazon, find it on any bookstore. And he's got all of his other books on his website, which I will leave in the show notes as well. And before I go into the episode, please just remember to subscribe to this podcast. And if you are on iTunes, please do leave a review as it helps us get our podcast out to more listeners. So without further ado, here's Dr. Gavin Francis. Welcome to the show, Gavin. Thank you so much for joining me today. I know you're a very, very busy doctor, father and writer. So thank you for joining me on the podcast.
Yeah, you're welcome, Meenal. Thanks for having me on.
How have you been, Gavin? How have you been throughout the last year or two, throughout the pandemic?
Oh, well, that's a big question. It started off quite terrifying, of course, for many of us in general practice. It's been ups and downs. It's been a bit of a roller coaster journey. Since vaccinations were rolled out, things have been an awful lot easier in general practice, certainly. And over the last few weeks, we've all been weathering this big Omicron wave, and I've been startled by how many of my staff and colleagues have been downed by Omicron that were fine throughout the first two or even three waves. So yeah, we've been very busy and short-staffed, but we're getting there.
Gavin, have you been affected by COVID at all, or have you been managed to luckily escape it?
I think I had it in May 2020, although I tested negative then, but we were still in lockdown and I became really very unwell for 4 or 5 days with COVID symptoms. And then I have caught Omicron, in the last month or so, like so many others.
How was that, Gavin? How did you feel with...
Fine. Yeah, I just, I've had 3 vaccines and essentially I just had a head cold for a few days, but for somebody who's been doing lateral flow testing week in, week out for months and months, it was really startling to see how that very thick, obvious line of my lateral flow tests appear and then hang around. It was quite enduring for at least 10 days.
Are you recovered now? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine. I've just got a slight dry cough, but I'm doing all right.
Well, I haven't caught it yet. Neither has anybody in my family. But there's this like lingering anxiety, thinking that I'm probably going to get it now because it's spreading so fast. I know we've been vaccinated, so thank God for the vaccines. Because if not, it would have been a lot scarier, I think. And we've had members of our family who've become unwell, but I just can't imagine them becoming unwell without the vaccine. Because I know that they would probably have ended up in hospital, and it's just so scary to think what the world would be like if we hadn't had the vaccination program roll out so quickly.
It was certainly very impressive, and I've taken great heart by the speed at which red tape was cut and great strides of cooperation have been made between Big corporations and governments all around the world. Obviously, we've still got a long way to go in terms of vaccine equity. And it's completely revealed, hasn't it, just to what an extraordinary extent many countries in the world have very little in the way of primary care infrastructure. So many countries, they have ordered vaccines. Vaccines have been made available. They've arrived in the capital cities, but they don't have the infrastructure to be able to roll them out properly. And it's really, for me anyway, been kind of heartening to see how well general practice and primary care in the UK has risen to the challenge. But it's also made me realise just how undeveloped primary care is in so many countries around the world who haven't managed to roll out the vaccines with the same kind of speed.
How has it been in general practice with your patients? My husband works in general practice, and he tells me about stories of patients who become unwell because they decided they didn't want the vaccine, or patients who've called in for months trying to figure out if the vaccine is the right thing for them. And sometimes he comes home from work with a big glow in his face saying, you know, like, my patients who've been worried about the vaccine for months, I managed to speak to them, even though I had to call them back so many times, but now they've decided to get the vaccine. And how has it been for you? Has it been difficult with your patients? Have you found it difficult to convey the message of the importance of vaccination?
Yes and no. Yes, with some people, it's been a bit of a tough slog in order to convince them that the benefits far, far outweigh any small potential risks. But on the whole, I think my population in Edinburgh, in Scotland, where I work, the people have been very accepting. I've had very few vaccine refusers. The vast, overwhelming majority of all my patients have had the vaccines.
I do think it does depend on your postcode as well, right? Where you are as a GP, and what part of the country you are, because the different demographics do affect the decisions that people make. So it's nice to hear that. Actually, I haven't heard that from a GP saying it's been all right.
Yeah, there's huge levels of public trust, I think, in my part of Scotland, and generally in Scotland, there's high levels of public trust in government. Mm. So that has all helped a lot, I think. And if you compare with other countries where there's lower public trust, you know, for the United States most famously, but also Austria has been very poor vaccination rates. Italy has had very poor vaccination rates. And it's really interesting to see the different kinds of factors that have been involved in those other situations. But I think on the UK, even the areas of the UK with poor vaccination rates, they're still better than many other countries around the world, because there's still, to a large extent, a degree of trust in the NHS.
What's the biggest challenge you faced in the last couple of years? And I ask, a challenge that you haven't faced at all as a GP that you face now in the pandemic. What's that been like?
I suppose the biggest challenge has been being obliged to conduct so much of our work at a distance, just because it became unsafe to have patients in the waiting room in their normal kind of density. And we had to take so many extra precautions doing home visits. So much of my work is about visiting vulnerable housebound elderly people. And so trying to reorganize general practice to be a distanced service has been extraordinarily difficult. And it wasn't at all how I was trained. You know, I'm sure your training was the same, Minal. It was always encouraged by your superiors to see the patient. If you've any doubt, always see the patient, listen to their chest, put your hand on their tummy, look into their ears, look into their eyes. You should go and actually just assess the patient yourself. And then suddenly we were confronted by a situation where it became potentially dangerous for us to just see the patients. And so we had to evolve very, very quickly a whole alternative parallel way of practicing medicine that was largely triage rather than real consultations, as I was taught how to carry out consultations.
So, where did you study medicine, Gavin?
Here in Edinburgh, where I am now. Yeah.
So were you born and raised practice in Edinburgh as well? Or?
Yeah, nearby. Yes, I was born just 20 miles away or so.
Yeah. So I studied medicine in Czech Republic in Prague, and I feel the way they taught us.
Beautiful city.
Oh, it's beautiful, but it's very cold. It's not for me, Gavin. I still wonder how I spent 6 years there, because I'm from sunny Gibraltar. And then I went to Prague for 6 years, and I still don't know how I did it, but I think the whole experience was really important for my own like personal development, because I was put outside my comfort zone. I had to learn Czech to speak to the patients there. Although I was taught in English, I had to, I mean, everything in my life, like going to the supermarket, I needed to speak in Czech. So the way they taught us in Prague was a very traditional way of medicine, which was a lot of theory, a lot of theory. I mean, I came out of medical school with so much knowledge that I knew I didn't need any of that when I started as a junior doctor. But we were so, our practical side was completely neglected. I mean, taking bloods, the physical exam was taught to us quite well, but I would say, like, you know, taking bloods, doing practical procedures wasn't something that they put an emphasis on. And even the way they did our examinations, we had to sit in front of a panel of doctors. And it was like almost like a Viva exam sort of thing. So it's a very traditional way. So when I came to the UK and I saw how different people studied, I realized how different it was. And now that I look back as my first years as a junior doctor, I realized that the methods of teachings are so different in so many different countries. And that really does have an impact on how you practice as a doctor. And I could see the UK doctors, because they spent time in the NHS and in the system, they kind of knew what to do. But a lot of foreign doctors who come into the system, even though they're so knowledgeable, and that's the thing, they have so much knowledge, there's no way to sort of put it into practice. So I've been a doctor for about a few years now in the NHS, and everything I learned in my second and third year, I mean, I've never used a Krebs cycle before. I've never had to use any of these things. So it's been an interesting few years for me in the NHS.
Yeah, well, ultimately medicine's still very, I mean, it's an old fashioned profession, isn't it? That you learn ultimately through a kind of apprenticeship model, and you have to learn all that stuff about, you know, Krebs cycles and all the names of all the tiny little muscles
and all the 20 amino acids. I mean, never gonna use it again in my life, but
but it gave you a great foundation on which you can build all the rest of it. And I think medicine is it's only partly about science. You have to know the science, but it's just the starting point. And once you've got the foundation of science, you can start then to really learn the job, which is about people and about figuring out with each consultation what kind of doctor that patient needs you to be. You know, do they need you to be some sort of emissary from a scientific establishment? Do they need you to be a sort of comforting arm around a shoulder? Do they need you to be just a conduit to a specialist? And I think the really great doctors are the ones that can figure out very, very quickly what kind of doctor they have to be for that patient to be most effective for them.
Yeah. I obviously have been on maternity leave this year, and then obviously with the pandemic, we were redeployed and working in different parts of the hospital that I wasn't planning to. So I haven't really set off in my career path just yet, but I'm enjoying the different experiences that I'm getting. What was it like for you, Gavin? Did you go straight into your foundation years and then go straight into GP practice?
Oh, no, not at all. No, I don't know if you're aware that only some of my books are medical books. Other books I've written are about travel. And when I came out of medical school, I first of all, I just did my house jobs in the old-fashioned system. This was in the late 90s. And then I spent 10 years traveling, doing sort of 6 months on, 6 months off. I traveled all around the world. I worked as an expedition doctor for a while in Antarctica. I wrote books about the Arctic, and then I initially trained in A&E medicine, and I was an A&E middle grade doctor for a while. And then, but really on getting back from Antarctica, I realized that I didn't want to do emergency medicine anymore, that I really wanted to do general practice. And so that was in 2004 2005, and I shifted then to training as a GP. And it was just the best decision for me. I love being a GP. It's a wonderful job, because you have this extraordinary variety. You meet all kinds of people, rich and poor, young and old, from all kinds of walks of life. And you do little practical things to help them and make their lives better and ease their suffering in a very kind of autonomous way. And you're extraordinarily autonomous as a GP, which I really love. And then I really enjoy the fact that you jump between all the different specialties. You know, every day I'm reading and I'm writing letters to psychoanalytic psychotherapists to orthopedic surgeons to cardiologists to physiotherapists, and you sort of dip in and out of so many worlds as a GP that for somebody like me who likes people and likes variety, it's a really perfect job. So I can't recommend
that enough. Antarctica, Gavin? That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's just the British have three bases that are permanently staffed with doctors, or they did in those days. One of them at the moment, because of worries over the calving iceberg, is not staffed through the winter right now. But there's usually three bases that need a doctor, and they're all hundreds and hundreds of miles from any other kind of human habitation. And so they take doctors that have got good grounding in emergency medicine and who are quite happy with their own company. And you set off usually in October or November of one year. You get down there in the middle of the Antarctic summer, and then you stay on your base for a year and come back usually about 18 months later. And I can't recommend that highly enough either. It's a wonderful experience for somebody who likes travel and is happy practicing independently. And, to live and work in Antarctica in the most sort of pristine landscape on Earth, this place of only ice and light and silence and penguins, was one of the wonderful treats of my life. You know, it's something I still think about a lot.
I watched an episode of Anthony Bourdain, his series Parts Unknown, and he filmed one episode there in Antarctica. And I think he went at a time in the summer, so there was always daylight, the sun never set. And he said, I couldn't sleep at night because, you know, the light was shining through my windows. And then in the documentary, they showed how they have the scientists and engineers in Antarctica and how they've created their own sort of ecosystem where everybody helps each other, and they've all created this little community and this little world that they just seem so happy with everything that they don't care about not being involved in what's happening outside.
Yeah, not at all. No, it's a real privilege to be there. The base I was on was a very tiny base. It was just 14 people for
14 people.
14 people for 14 months. Yeah.
Wow. And you were their doctor for 14 months.
Yep. But they were all young, fit, healthy people. You know, nothing much happened.
So basically you had fun for 14 months, Gavin, is that
right? Well, yeah, I mean, I had to be there, and I had to do dental checks and things like that, and occasionally, you know, develop x-rays in the bath when people were fell and hurt themselves. But yeah, it was just a wonderful opportunity to spend a bit of time thinking and reflecting about what I wanted to do with my life.
And, that's a long time to be there.
Yeah, but you can't get in or out after a certain time because the sea freezes over and it becomes dangerous to land planes. And so once you're there, you really are there.
What kind of things were you reflecting on, Gavin? And how old were you at that time?
What age was I when I went down? I think I was 28. I guess I'd been very, very busy until then. You know what it's like if you study medicine, you have to work hard at school, you have to get straight A's, then you go straight into medical school, and that's also very hard. Do 6 years of that, and then when you finish medical school, you go on to junior doctor training, which is very it's just a bit of an ordeal in terms of the hours and the steep learning curve. And I felt I'd been on the kind of conveyor belt since I was about 15, since I started to study for my school exams. And it was a wonderful time just to step off that either a conveyor belt or hamster wheel, however you want to think about it, and think about what I really wanted to do with my life. And, I'd always been a great reader. I'd always read all kinds of books, very kind of omnivorous tastes, I suppose you could say. And when I was in Antarctica, it was the first chance that I actually had the time and space to learn to write. So I wrote my first book when I was down there and really enjoyed the whole experience of writing a book. And so when I came back and sent it to some publishers and it got published, I just kept going. And so, you know, now I've written 8 books now. I just keep going because I discovered down there that it was something that I truly loved.
I think that's one of the issues we have as doctors, that I don't think that we get a chance to explore or pursue any of our passions or even find what we love, because the pace of life and the pace of our work is so fast, and it's obviously accelerated during the pandemic as well. I think I've had a chance to reflect on the stuff that I enjoy doing outside of medicine, because I had my maternity leave, and that was a period for me where I had a time to sit down and think, well, if I'm currently not working as a doctor, what else can I do? What else do I enjoy? And the podcast is one of those things. I think that our system doesn't allow us to have that time. And you know, you mentioned you've written 10 books in that period, which is incredible, because I mean, I wish more doctors listen to this podcast and understand that you can actually do things outside of medicine and you can pursue your passion.
It's starting to shift, and it's becoming more and more acceptable for people to insist on working less than full time, just because we're seeing in our profession so many people burning out and leaving the profession. And, you know, what an incredible waste. You spend 20 years training somebody to become this extremely skilled individual, very highly paid, and then they get burnt out and quit the profession. And I would far rather that the medical profession explores ways of people working less than full time much earlier in their career, rather than this business of junior doctors feeling that they have to run this gauntlet of horrendous hours for several years until they can then relax and kick back as a consultant. Because what they find is, of course, as a consultant, they were just working just as hard as they always did. So we need to learn as a profession how to pace ourselves much more, how to accommodate different kinds of patterns of work. It's been quite easy for me as a GP since I became a GP, because GP lends itself to that kind of autonomy. But unfortunately, many of my colleagues that are now hospital consultants, and they're the same age as me, you know, mid-40s, they're at the stage now where they're really at high risk of burnout, because they've been working at full tilt now for about 30 years since they started studying for their A-levels. And rather than lose all those incredibly talented people, we need to explore and make it much more normal for people to take sabbaticals and to work a four-day week, or if even a three-day week, and so on.
You've written a lovely book on recovery, which I really enjoyed reading, Gavin. I think a lot of people need to get their hands on this book, not just doctors, but anybody in any profession, in any walk of life. Actually, even if you don't have a job, you know, you should still read this book, because it's such an important window into the world of self-care, self-compassion, and you know, that understanding of your own body and your own mind as well, that we tend to not have the time to think about, because the world that we live in is just go, go, go. What compelled you to write on such a big topic?
Well, I wrote a book that came out last year about, came out just at the end of last year, about how terrible it's been working through this pandemic. And it's just all about, it's a kind of diary called Intensive Care, about how I have seen my colleagues in the community, both in emergency general practice and in daytime general practice and district nursing colleagues and so on, respond to the awful challenge of COVID. And so I'd spent a lot of time writing and thinking about COVID. And it struck me that more and more over the last couple of years, I've been speaking to my patients about convalescence and recovery, not just from COVID, but also from the really very damaging effects of the repeated lockdowns, which have been so horrendous for many of my patients' mental health. Do you know, as a GP, about a third of my consultations are mental health. But during enough, and in the periods just after these lockdowns in 2020 and 2021, it was rising to more like two-thirds of my work was about mental health. And I gradually dawned on me that I was spending so much time talking to people about concepts and ideas and principles of recovery that I take for granted, that none of my patients took for granted. You know, the idea that everybody's recovery is different, the idea that you have to learn a new language of the body and listen to it very carefully, the idea that you have to take a lot of care over your environment in which you're attempting to heal and recover, the idea that you have to that convalescence is a process that you have to give time, energy, and respect to. The idea, for example, that there's so many conditions in medicine, most of them, in fact, which are not actually curable by Western medicine, and medicine is a way of mitigating symptoms and of helping people live with their illness. And all these things were swirling around in my conversations with patients, and I thought, I just really need to put all these reflections in one place, one easily accessible, short book. You know, as you know yourself, it's very, you know, it's only about 100 pages long. It's very short. And it's just a kind of distillation of all those conversations about recovery and convalescence over that last couple of years.
Your book on recovery talks about different aspects of someone's life, whether it's their work, their home life, and the family. And obviously that does depend on, I guess it does also depend on where you live, the kind of environment around you. And there are lots of factors that play into your recovery from any disease or from any chronic condition. How much of a difference does it make on the kind of country you live in or the political system you're under that actually affects the length or quality of your recovery?
Mm. Well, I think it makes a huge difference. You know, we're very lucky in the UK to have the benefit of the NHS, which is free at the point of the demand. So where you know, I don't have to send bills to my patients. My patients don't need to worry about where the money's coming to pay for their prescriptions. In Scotland, you know, prescription medication is all paid for through general taxation. So it's essentially free when you go and pick up your medications. We have a very patchy, but at least we have a kind of welfare benefits system for people to be off sick, although it's not as good as we could have. So all these things do mean that we have at least the opportunity to try to recover in the UK. Some countries do it better. So for example, if you look at, say, the Scandinavian countries, they have much better sickness benefits, welfare benefits. They're much better set up to look after people in the community than we are, because our community services aren't very good. We in the UK, we've put a huge emphasis on hospital treatments, but not so much on community. But Scandinavia don't have a lot of hospital beds either, because they've put things into community care. But then if you go somewhere like Germany's got quadruple the number of hospital beds than we have. So per head of population, you're much more likely to be able to enjoy a slow, more adequate recovery in the hospital in Germany than you are in the UK. So they do things a lot better. And of course, the sort of downward comparison in matters of health is always the United States, where, you know, if you look at infant mortality rates, for example, in the United States, they're really horrendous. And considering that in the United States, the population pays three times more for healthcare than we do in the UK, but they have much, much worse outcomes. And sickness benefits are very poor in the United States as well. So there's, if you look around the world, there's all these different systems have been set up with different kind of levels of emphasis on community care, on hospital convalescence, on opportunities to let people still have an income while they're off sick. And I don't think any country has got it right. No country's got it perfect. But what I wanted to do with this book is point out that we really have, in the last 50 years in this country, undervalued the importance of giving adequate energy and respect to the process. And I would love to see that balance redressed. And we've cut hospital beds in this country so hard, so fast. You know, we've lost half of our hospital beds since 1988. We've gone from 300,000 to 150,000. And I think that's gone far too far. We need to reverse it, because we don't have the kind of community backup and support that they have in, for example, Sweden. We can't afford to have so few hospital beds, because we don't really have the adequate community care resources to be able to cope with such a small, restricted hospital system. That's my position anyway. And it's my constant bugbear as a GP that it is almost impossible for me to admit a frail, vulnerable patient somewhere for essentially nursing care, because they can't cope at home. there has to be a diagnosis in place, and there has to be a plan to get the patient out again as soon as possible, which doesn't do them any favors. And similarly in mental health care, it's almost impossible now for me to admit a patient in having an acute crisis of their mental health to a hospital bed. The only way you can get someone into a hospital is if they're a danger to themselves or a danger to other people, and then you can get them admitted. But just admitting someone to psychiatric hospital for a humanitarian reason to ease their suffering is something that we just don't do anymore. And I think it's something we should do.
That's really interesting, Gavin, because I think about some of the patients I see, and you talk about mental health especially, and when you speak to patients in the hospital and they've had a crisis and you're sending them back to their family or back to the place where they had that crisis, you just wonder that if I'm sending them back to the place they've come from with that problem, how much help is that going to be? And you just wonder if there's any way that we can spend time with them in hospital, talk to them more. And as doctors, we always want to go the extra mile, but we just can't because we don't have the capacity, and we're told that we just have to discharge patients because we're tight on beds or we're short on beds. Do you think any country has sort of hit the nail on the head with that? I mean, you mentioned Germany has more beds. And do you think the system works in that way, where they use hospitals for recovery and not just treating symptoms and then sending them home?
Yeah, I think Germany is probably a good example. I mean, Germany's got much better hospital system than we have. But, you know, Germany pays about a third more than us for their healthcare. So they've got a partially privatized system there in Germany with insurance and so on. So it's not quite the American system, but they do pay a lot more for their healthcare than we do. And so if we want to keep an NHS that's free at the point of use, and which I dearly would like to do, then we have to increase the resources of the NHS through some kind of more progressive tax. If you want to keep the same system but improve it to the level of a German system, then it needs to have some more money in it. The Germans have done that by making people pay more separately for an insurance scheme. But I think they have got a far better system. And you can see that just in Germany, the death rates from COVID have been far lower than we've seen in our country, which has been really startling to see. So we've got a lot to learn from them, I think.
Oh, we're already seeing in the last couple of years how the NHS, we're always seeing it's at breaking point. And especially after the pandemic, we've seen the impact it's had on the NHS. What do you think is going to happen over the next few years in terms of A, our political system and how they're controlling the NHS, and B, the impacts that COVID has had on health issues in the UK, not just COVID directly, but everything else around it? I know it's a very big question, Gavin.
If I had a magic crystal ball, I wish I did. Yeah. I don't know what's going to happen. I'm constantly astonished by the politics of this country. I have absolutely no idea what's going to happen next. I mean, I was just amazed, for example, that Brexit went through, because I could see that from my point of view, it was clearly going to impoverish the country. But yet people still voted for it because of an ideological attachment to a concept of a more independent Britain. So clearly that concept of an independent Britain was more important to them than actual quality of life or resources or the economy. So people make decisions in politics that I don't particularly understand. I don't think any political party in the UK could get away with abolishing the NHS, because they would be immediately hammered at the next election, because in general, people really love the NHS so much. And you can see that on all sides, but you can see it in the very, very high vaccine uptake rate. You could see it in all the Thursday claps that people were doing through the worst months of COVID. You can see also the effect of, remember that just before the Brexit vote in 2016, there was this business of this big red Boris bus that had a slogan on it about the NHS. And there's a lot of impartial observers have said that slogan about taking the money that we give to the EU and giving it to the NHS, that was a really powerful, potent slogan, because people love the NHS so much. And so any slogan that said we should redirect money from here and into the NHS is a popular one. And I think it was you know, it really is illuminating how that approach to the voters hit home, and it shows just how important the NHS always will be for the voters. So if you ask what is going to happen in the next 5 years, my first answer would be, I have no idea, but I don't see the NHS going anywhere very fast because the voters wouldn't tolerate it.
What do you think is going to happen with our COVID patients? Because you, especially in your book about recovery, the different aspects involved in helping people overcome these sort of chronic diseases, we're seeing a lot of patients with long COVID as well. Do you think there's been enough emphasis to tackle the impact that COVID's had on patients?
No, not at all, because we're sort of drowning in demand, because we've got such a huge backlog now after 2 years of this, when hospitals have been by necessity focusing on management of COVID. And so we've got this enormous backlog of all these other health problems that have been unaddressed. And there isn't a huge extra funds of money going in. So the NHS is dealing with the fallout of a new condition, which is people with persistent enduring symptoms after COVID. But it's also dealing with this phenomenal backlog of all the routine work that we used to do. So, you know, people who work within the NHS are very committed, and they will do their best, and they will try to manage their patients as best they can within the restricted resources that have been allowed. But without huge extra resources and massive increases in staffing and lots better community physio support and rehabilitation support, I don't think we're going to see a particular new channel of resource opened up to manage all those patients. I think, as it always happens in the NHS, professional people, doctors and nurses, will get on and do the best they can. But it's going to be very difficult without extra resources.
Well, the issue is, Gavin, I mean, I'm talking about the recovery of patients from COVID and the backlog of issues that we need to deal with, but then that's just one part of the story, because then you've got doctors and nurses who also want to take a break, who also need to recover, mm-hmm. and they're part of the picture as well. So it almost seems like everything is just going to collapse. I mean, I'm worried. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few years. My husband's a GP, and he says that even just now, doctors and nurses around him, they're exhausted, they're tired. What do you think doctors and nurses can do at this point, where they're stuck between the NHS needing them so much, but then them also needing the time to recover from a really, really stressful 2 years?
We need to increase our numbers, of course. I mean, we're missing something like 40,000 nurses in this country. We're missing a lot of doctors too. We are belatedly expanding our medical school numbers. And so where I teach at the University of Edinburgh is hugely expanding its student numbers. We're going up from just over 200 a year, we're going up to just under 300 a year. And if that's happening in medical schools all over the country, we are going to, in 5 or 6 years, have a lot more graduates, which is a good thing. But, you know, when I was talking earlier about the importance of working less than full time, even though it sounds paradoxical, that if we need doctors to be more at the front line, we shouldn't be allowing them to work less than full time. But if we don't, then they're just going to leave the profession. So I think as a profession, we need to make it much, much easier for people to take sabbaticals, to drop to 80% or 70% full time, and so that they can rediscover what it is that they love about the job and do it with renewed enthusiasm and vigor and stay in the job much longer. Whereas at the moment, we've got so many people retiring as soon as they possibly can in their mid-50s or their late-50s, depending on their pensions. But if we can restore the love of the profession that I feel, you know, I love my job. I've got no intention of trying to stop doing it or wanting to take early retirement. But I want to see the kind of approach I have of less than full time taken much, much more widely and promoted as a way of helping people to re-energize and re-inspire them with what the great things about working in medicine are.
And Gavin, are you working less than full time at the moment? Do you take some time to work and to write as well?
Yeah, I mean, I've got young kids, so I look after my kids half the week. So 2.5 days a week, I'm at home with my kids, and 2.5 days a week, I'm in the clinic. And then I work at the weekends for the out-of-hours service, and I do occasional locums, just once or twice, sometimes three times a year in the small islands in the Western Isles of Scotland or the Northern Isles of Scotland. So I have a really varied kind of portfolio of things that I do. And I'm also, for sure, 2 days a week at home with my kids, thinking about medicine and decompressing too about my busy days in the clinic. And it's a pattern that really, really works for me to work full out, 10-hour day, because you really have to give your all in a full day of general practice. But then I have a day off afterwards to recover, you know, and I take the kids to school and I pick them up again afterwards. And I've got some time while they're in school to sit and reflect and think about it and write. And that's when I write my books.
So Gavin, what's next for you then? Have you got another book in the pipeline? Are you going back to Antarctica? Are you doing anything crazy over the next few years?
No, I'm always writing something. So at the moment, I'm finishing off a book about a hero figure of mine. It's a 17th century English doctor, a chap called Thomas Brown, that I love his books and his writing very much, even though he's 350 years out of date now. But I'm writing a short book about him. And I'm also working on a very long essay about dementia and forgetting. So I've got lots of different things on the go to keep me interested on those 2 days a week I'm at home.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Gavin. I highly recommend your book to everybody because it gave me a whole new perspective on, well, recovery, but also understanding what that word means, definition of that. I think we just see recovery as just sitting in bed for a week after a pneumonia and then, or after a fractured leg, but it can take months, you know, to fully become not just who you were before the disease, but become a better version of yourself and to respect your body in that way. How can people order your book and how can people get their hands on it?
Yeah, just wherever they normally buy their books, you can get it everywhere. I mean, it's in the top 10 bestsellers this week, so it'll be in all the bookshops and you can order it up on bookshop.org or on Amazon or whatever it is that you buy them.
Well, I love how casually you said that, Gavin. It's on the top 10 bestseller book this week. You've had so many bestseller books and you're just like, yeah, it's just another one.
Oh, no, I saw it. No, it never, and that never gets stale. That's always lovely. It's always lovely. Does well.
Well, I very much look forward to your future books as well, Gavin. And I need to read about more of your travel stories because that sounds very interesting. And if you do get a chance, watch the episode of Anthony Bourdain in Antarctica. I think it might bring back some nice memories for you.
Yeah, I will. Thanks for letting me know.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning into this episode. And thank you, Dr. Francis, for your time. This was a bit of a shorter episode, but we both had our children to tend to it and we had to tuck them into bed. But as always, I'm so grateful for my guests who give me their time and wisdom to share with you all. I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find more episodes of Meenal's World on my website, meenalviz.com, where I have a library of over 50 episodes with guests who I'm sure will inspire you in your own journey of self-discovery and learning and unlearning. You can follow me on social media at Dr. Meenal Viz, where I very regularly check my DMs. So feel free to drop me a message, tell me what you think of these episodes or any other guests you'd like to have on as well. Have a lovely week ahead and I'll see you all next Friday.